This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about precarious employment, what it means and who it affects. But before we get into that, we're continuing last week's conversation about pride in Indiana. With us now is Tom Sizemore to talk about the bag ladies, who they were and their role in Indiana's LGBTQ community. Welcome, Tom. Thank you so much for joining us today. Let's start off with, who are the bag ladies, or who were they?
Well, they still are. This is our going into our 41st year as a fundraising organization. We started out many years ago just as a group of guys that wanted to make a difference. And they started a fundraiser at a bar one night that raised $2,000 that they sent some to New York to the gay men's health crisis and kept some here in case we needed it for our local our local folks, which we did. And that's what kicked off the bag ladies and their fundraising efforts.
So was there sort of an impetus that started the bag ladies? Was there a moment that it was just like, we're going to do this, or did it just happen by chance?
Well, I mean, back, you know, when HIV AIDS first came about and this gay cancer that was happening, it was killing all of our friends. We thought we needed to do something. So we weren't really quite sure what to do. So the best thing to do, we thought, was probably raise money for research. And the only people we knew at the time that was doing any type of research like that was the gay men's health crisis in New York. And so that's where we thought we should, you know, put our efforts, which we started in the very beginning doing. And then quickly, you know, started something here locally as we start to see the trickle effects of the HIV and AIDS come to Indiana and affect the people that we love and all of our friends.
Mm-hmm. And what was your involvement with the bag ladies? Were you there when it started?
No, I'm not quite that old. I'm only 53. but I worked for a gentleman by the name of Kobe Palmer, who is one of the original founders of the bag ladies. He's a very well-known florist and philanthropist here in the city. I came to work one day and I saw this stuff on the ground of sequins and glitter and beads and stuff. And he's like, oh, that's the bag ladies. And I'm like, okay, what are they? And he told me, and at the time, all the people I was growing up with or coming out with, unfortunately all died of HIV. So I thought, well, I've got to do something myself. So I became involved over about 24, 25 years ago. So almost half my adult life. And this is my 20th anniversary of being a former bag lady queen.
Wow. So what makes the bag ladies unique to Indiana?
I think for the simple fact that we are probably the nation's oldest now HIV fundraising organization. There's a lot of organizations and groups that have been going on for years, but we have specifically been designated for HIV funding, education, research, and that sort of thing. Which I think sets us apart a little bit. But, you know, yeah, I mean, just doing what we can and that many years ago and still doing it today, I think is a testament of the need that we still have to continue this fight against HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm. And what about when the bag ladies first began, or even when you were part of it, you said about 25 years ago, what was the reaction from the public? Was it different than what it is now?
Yes, very much so. Back in the day, we were called the bag ladies. And when we tried to get, you know, assistance from corporate funding and things like that, we realized that that name was not particularly going to fly with the heterosexual community, if you will. So we came up with a name called Indiana Cares. So that's what our original inception was Indiana Cares. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And we ran through that many years. And throughout the history of the Indiana Cares, we weaved with different other health organizations to try to facilitate this money that we were raising. Our biggest fundraiser that we contribute to is called the DEFA Fund, which is a direct emergency financial assistance fund for people with HIV and AIDS. And what I particularly love about this fund is the fact that it doesn't matter who you are. If you're white, black, gay, straight, bi, trans, whatever, if you're affected, we're going to help you. And back then when people were being thrown out of their homes because they were simply gay, let alone have HIV and AIDS, they couldn't pay their rent. They couldn't get medication. They couldn't get basic necessities like their lights to live. And this fund was able to provide that much needed assistance so that they could just, you know, feel loved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so what are some of the things that the bag ladies has been able to do to fundraise in support of HIV AIDS awareness?
Well, throughout the years, we had three major fundraisers that we did each year. One is the Bag Lady Bus Tour, which is held every October, Saturday closest to Halloween. And we charter buses, and we dress in campy drag, and we have fun names. A lot of us still leave our facial hair and just throw glitter in and things like that. So it's all about camp. But we did that. We did the Indiana AIDS Walk many years ago. We started that going, as well as something called the Garage Party, which one of the owners of a local bar would donate a car every year that would be auctioned off and raffled off. So we were able to raise quite a bit of money through those fundraisers, as well as many smaller things we did, like coat checks at different bars, cake walks, rummage sales, car washes, anything that would raise some money, and of course, drag shows and things like that. But anything that would raise money, we would do.
Nice. So a lot of different things. Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's tiring, but it's a lot of fun. It's very, very rewarding. And I'd like to share something real quick, if I may, that really changed my life. Mm-hmm. If I could say it without breaking down. There used to be a nursing home facility here called Parkview Manor. And it was on 46 in Keystone. And it was the only nursing home facility for people with HIV and AIDS. And one of the residents said, "Would the bag ladies attend my funeral? Because if they don't, no one will." That changed my life forever. Would just be that way. And that was the times, you know? And so, of course, we were there. And, of course, we've always supported people who had no one. And I think that's what the bag ladies have been endeared by the community in Indianapolis, is the fact that we will help anyone that needs us. Mm-hmm. We've raised money for cystic fibrosis. We've raised money for cancer, the Little Red Door. I mean, so while our main fundraising is based in HIV and AIDS, we've also lent our quote unquote talents, if you will, to other organizations to help them raise money and awareness for their causes.
Right, right. Well, thank you for sharing that touching story. I mean, I got chills from that. That's just unbelievable. Well, if you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Well, Tom, I want to know a little bit more about the Bag Ladies, I guess, role with establishing the Damien Center. Can you tell us what that center is and what the Bag Ladies did with that?
Well, the Damien Center is a facility that would, once the funds were raised, they would host different workshops or meetings or support groups. Because again, back, you know, many, many years ago in the late 80s, early 90s, people were having a hard time dealing with or even talking to people about their status. I remember as a young man getting tested myself, and I was given a fake name because you weren't given your real name, or you were given a number. And, you know, they started with the Damien Center as a way to help facilitate these organizations and these programs, but we were the funding behind it. So mm-hmm. while we didn't really start the programs they had, we helped fund the programs that they were doing at that time. One was called the Buddy House, which was a house where people would go to live that had nowhere else to go. And that lasted for a while. And, you know, many of the things evolved and changed over the years. And we helped with prevention and education. We did little packets, much like Step Up does now, which is, you know, going to different bars and restaurants and having safe sex packets. We had a campaign called Nurse Safe Sex, who went and talked about, you know, being responsible for your health and being responsible for your actions and playing safe. So it's evolved over the years of what we did as actual group, as far as funding different organizations and different programs, which many are still going today. The biggest that I personally am involved with is the Kobe Palmer Food Pantry, located at the Damien Center. And it's a way that we can just provide these food for people who are still struggling to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about with the pandemic and everything? Did that affect the Bag Ladies and the work that you do?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I said, one of our big fundraisers was the bus tour that we would do every year, which, mm-hmm. you know, entails getting on three buses. We start out by swearing in the virgins, if you will, and going around to different clubs and being silly and taking photos and collecting donations and sponsors and pledges. And we weren't able to do that this year. And each year we recognize an outstanding bag lady who's went above and beyond, and we crown her Bag Lady Queen. And we weren't able to do that this year, but fortunately for us, we have a phenomenal Bag Lady Queen, Miss Barbara Please, who is continuing her second year. So hopefully we will be able to have a bus tour this year. But in the meantime, there was still the need for these funds to be raised. So we tried to do different things via online, Zoom events, social distancing events. I did one where we sold pumpkins at Halloween dressed like Bag Lady Queens and auctioned them off. They've done other things where they've went to people's homes and did yard parties where they could be outside and still be around people, but social distancing. And those were done through donations of people that wanted us to come and appear at their place or their event or their party or what have you. But it really drastically cut down on the monies that we were able to raise, and we're trying to play catch up now. So any future events you see happening, please attend and donate generously, please.
And what can people expect as we get ready to wrap up here for the Bag Ladies this year? Any events coming up?
Yes, actually, we have one. It's July 3rd, held at Greg's. It's called the USO Show. It's probably, I think, like the sixth or seventh year we've done this particular one. My alter ego, Ivana Moorhead, will be hosting as well as performing. And the money will be split, I believe, between the Little Red Door and the DEFA Fund. Awesome. And, of course, we're going to have the bus tour and hopefully the bus tour and things like that. But we always have a pride show, which we just did a few weeks ago. We have a holiday show. So we have several events throughout. And everyone can go to the Bag Ladies on Facebook and check them out. And it shows all the former queens, what they look like, their personas, and that sort of thing.
Well, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that you're also a former Bag Lady Queen, correct?
20 years ago, yes, 2001. And that's the other thing I love about the Bag Ladies is they don't take themselves too seriously. We have names like Lily Endowment, Patio Doors, Crystal Flash, like mine is Ivana Moorhead. You know, it's just fun, silly stuff.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate having you on. Time Sizemore, former Bag Lady Queen in 2001, also known as Ivana Moorhead. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with new guests after a quick break. We'll be talking about the health of people working low-quality jobs during the pandemic. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. We love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. With us now is Emily Ahonen, Associate Professor at Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Welcome, Emily. Can you tell us a bit about this research project you're a part of?
Sure. My collaborators and I have been focused on work understood broadly and its relationship to health equity for a while. And so when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, we started thinking about what precarious employment might mean specifically during the pandemic. And we started thinking, you know, workers in the food sector are critical to maintaining and securing our food supply. Older workers in essential food provision positions face a disproportionate burden of exposure and consequences. And there's also a disproportionate representation of people of color in essential food jobs. And that might be contributing to the high burden of COVID-19 in those populations. And we also figured that because of the nature of their jobs, many food workers might not be able to follow prevention guidelines and social distance because of their work. So as we were thinking about all these issues and the fact that American society was depending on precariously employed workers to ensure our access to essential goods and services, we wanted to describe how precarious employment might shape access to resources and opportunities necessary to prevent the coronavirus. And so that's where we got started with the study.
And what made you focus? I think you were specifically focusing on food workers for this project. What made you go that route?
Well, what we started noticing was when we started deeming certain groups of work essential, that some of those groups of workers got a lot more attention and would have been a lot more practiced at prevention of infectious diseases than others. So, you know, for instance, medical care workers have a lot of experience with using that sort of PPE and infection control. But other essential workers, like those responsible for ensuring our food supply, don't deal with this on a daily basis, and they were getting talked about a lot less, but they're quite a big portion of the labor force. And so because of that, and because so many food workers are precariously employed, we thought that this was a group of people whose work experiences needed some extra attention.
Right, right. Well, you've mentioned the precariously employed, and I'm hoping we can sort of define what that is a little bit for our audience and what that means. What is a precarious employee or precarious employment?
Sure. Well, I'll begin by saying that precarious employment is based on the employment relationship. So that means, you know, someone has a job working for someone else, and that defines their relationship. And definitions of precarious employment have shifted a little over time, but in general, when we say precarious employment, what we mean is employment that accumulates traits that are less desirable for workers. And it's generally referring to things like instability or insecurity in that relationship, how long the job might last under what conditions. It often means inadequate income and a lack of rights and social protections. So things like access to unemployment benefits if the job is lost. And when a job accumulates those sorts of unwanted factors, we call that precarious employment.
Mm-hmm. Are there any jobs that people would be surprised to find out they fall under precarious employment? Like, would a freelancer fall under that?
Well, that's part of the area where definitions are evolving and changing, because one aspect of precarious employment is a relationship to an employer. And so when freelancers are working for someone else and they have this sort of unpredictability or inadequate pay and lack of access to social protections, then we might start talking about that work as precarious.
Okay. And then if someone was looking for signs to know whether they are in a situation like that, is there anything specific? I know you mentioned like insecure about whether you're still going to have your job or not. Maybe there's no benefits. Is there anything else?
Well, we often talk about whether or not people have ability to grow and evolve in a job, and whether they have control over when they work, their working times, and whether that's predictable. And we also think about things like interpersonal power. So how much influence do people have about things like working time or about their pay? And do they feel that they can broach those issues without fear of losing that job? So some of those things come along with many situations of precarious employment.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking back to past jobs I've had, and I'm wondering, was I ever in that situation where, you know, it's like every week the schedule is completely different and you don't know, and you get called in, and if you don't show up, it's like, well, we'll just find someone else. And it's very stressful.
Sure. Yeah. And I think one thing it's important to say about precarious employment is that whether or not people use that name to define their experiences, certainly when you start talking to people about aspects of what makes employment precarious, like things you're saying, unpredictability, lack of control, potential to be fired abruptly, they're intimately familiar with that reality, and they will know whether they experience those things, whether or not they would use the term for precarious employment to define that experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the reasons that talking about things by name sometimes matters and sometimes doesn't. People's realities don't change regardless of what we call them. But I think in terms of social dialogue, when we start naming something and start calling it an experience in itself, we might start to question whether it has to be that way or whether the circumstances could be changed.
Right, right. Well, do you think this type of employment is more common than we realize? Is that what's moving most of the industries around us?
Well, I guess whether we think about how common it is or not, studies in the U.S. are still in early days of precarious employment, but a few recent studies using big nationally representative data sets have suggested that between, 12 and 31% of people in those samples anyway could be called precariously employed, depending on what aspects were included in the researchers' definitions. And so that's not a small proportion of the U.S. labor force. And to the second part of your question, this is not a thing that is limited to certain industries. Precarious employment can exist in any kind of occupation or industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you were talking about the definitions and things, I was realizing that. I think when I've heard the term before, I just automatically thought it was, an entry-level job where you're just trying to make it. And yeah, people are like, you got to make your way up the ladder and pay your dues. But it can be anything, really. You could be an advanced level in your company and still face it.
You could. And you're bringing up an important point about precarious employment's relationship to health. And that's that some of its influence on health appears to depend on life phase. So, at different points in our life, what we need and expect from employment are different. And our health as people is constantly evolving over time. And so, when you refer to somebody who's just starting out and thinking that this might be a stepping stone to something else, there are specific forms of precarious employment that refer to that reality. And then there's the sort of precarious employment where it may or may not change and workers are in a life phase where that is going to be more problematic for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does one change the idea that this is just the way things are when it comes to precarious employment?
Well, I think one way to answer your question is that when we start thinking about employment more structurally, right? Sometimes we can think of jobs in a very small way, right? This one job is like this, or a certain kind of person has jobs like this. But when we think about work and employment as an institution that societies create, that we collectively create, we can also think about ways to change it to work better for us. And, that doesn't happen overnight, but it can and does happen. Think, for instance, about limits on daily or weekly work hours or days off. There's an old joke that unions are the group that brought us the weekend, right? Mm-hmm. And we can make that joke because there was a time when we didn't think of employment as something that everyone deserved time off from. And so I think one way to think of precarious employment as not inevitable is when we think about employment and work as experiences that we've invented as societies and we collectively shape, and we can reshape them to be better for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I want to talk a little bit more about sort of the health issues related to precarious employment. Do you think the pandemic highlighted some of the health issues surrounding that?
I would say that it certainly brought employment quality and precarious employment to the forefront in a way that I haven't seen in my career before. Precarious employment is sort of an understudied determinant of health, but as the pandemic unraveled, it became pretty apparent that many workers are simultaneously experiencing high levels of contact with the public, which we now know is really important to the spread of the coronavirus, but they also might not be able to practice strict social distancing, work remotely from home. They might not even have paid time off. And so all of these things that workers have experienced for a long time, including work that isn't especially well paid, all of those things became very clear in the pandemic, where staying home might be really important to prevent infection, but might be really problematic for people who aren't very highly paid and don't have paid time off. They may not have a lot of savings to fall back on if they needed or wanted to stay home. And so I think we've begun to talk more about employment and also to start to think about how reliant employees are on their employers and government policy to provide them with protections when we are faced with extreme situations.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, how are people's health directly affected by precarious employment? Is there like a trend that you see among the folks that you've been studying?
Well, research on precarious employment and health is fairly early in the U.S. And what we think is that the ways that precarious employment is attached to health is through these sort of material limitations we've been talking about, right? Not enough money or not enough money to buy tangible things that people need. Also through exposure to occupational hazards and through employment-related stressors, like feeling insecure or feeling a sense of unfairness about pay or circumstances. And what we see in the U.S. so far is that those people who have precarious employment compared to better quality employment situations tend to report poorer self-rated health, like when people get asked to generally say how healthy they are. And they tend to report a higher prevalence of different forms of psychological distress than people who have higher quality employment.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine if it's so unpredictable, that just cannot be good. That can be very stressful.
Yeah, people are very creative and resourceful, but these are real strains that come with precarious employment situations.
Well, are there any resources out there to help folks who find themselves in these kinds of situations?
There are, and I would start by saying that anything that puts workers in connection and solidarity with each other can help over time. So things like worker centers, unions, even staff committees within a workplace can be good tools for workers to use to come together and talk about their employment situations. And that can bring forth more ideas and good strategies for advocating for themselves for changes that might support them. The other thing that I would say is that elected officials are a huge part of shaping what is possible in terms of employment laws and enforcement of them and who has access to what resources and protections. And so we can and should make our elected officials at the city, state, and federal level aware that precarious employment matters to us and to our communities. And so helping them understand that support of their constituents in this way is an opportunity to leverage employment as a positive for the health of their constituent communities. And so we can think about each other as resources because we're all part of this society that we can shape. And we can think about those people who we've given official titles to use to advocate for us as responsible for working on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you mentioned unions and things like that. Would a union replace laws or would laws be better than unions to address precarious employment?
I would not take either of those things off the table. I think, you know, because they're both relevant, right? Laws and enforcement about what's allowed in employment relationships are really important. They historically shape what employers do. Employers are really important because they have the power to shape what employment experiences are like for people who work in their companies. And unions, historically, or other worker collectives like worker centers or worker advocacy groups, can help shift that power balance between employer and employee that determine what employment is like for workers. And so I would say all of those efforts at all of those levels are necessary in order to improve precarious employment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you what's next with your research and where things stand.
Right now we're collecting data actively. And so we really would like to hear from food workers who are older than 50 in Indiana or Washington state who think they might have experienced precarious employment during the pandemic and to tell us about what that was like for them. So we're collecting data right now, and we will analyze those data as we have them and see what we can find that might influence public health messaging and prevention practices at work, and over time, hopefully contribute to better support for precariously employed people.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Emily, for your time today. We'll definitely want to check in once that study is complete and see what you found.
Thank you.
Emily Quinn Ihonen is an associate professor at Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. We'll be back after a quick break. We'll continue our conversation on precarious employment and talk about what's going on here in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, or you can send us a voice message without having to make a call. You can just use our smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. I'm Miriam Soh. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soh. Before the break, we were speaking about precarious employment, what it looks like, and who it's affecting. And as always, we love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're continuing our conversation on precarious employment, and we're joined by Fran Quigley, clinical professor at the IU Robert H. McKinney School of Law at IUPUI. Welcome, Fran. You direct a health and human rights clinic. Can you tell us about the work you do and how it relates to precarious employment?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show. The Health and Human Rights Clinic is one of the several clinics at the IU McKinney School of Law, which is, to be really direct about it, it's the first opportunity for our students to represent live in-person clients. And so we do advocate for those clients, students do, with supervision from me and others in the community. We specifically partner with Indiana Legal Services quite often. And we represent, in doing so, low-income folks. So sometimes it's representing low-income folks on a direct case where they have a housing case or an access to healthcare case or a wage theft case or something like that. And sometimes we will do broader advocacy where we'll try to change policy. We call that upstream advocacy, to try to prevent folks from facing the kind of struggles that we're seeing clients face right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, how big of an issue is health when it comes to those with precarious employment?
It's huge. It's huge, especially if you define health as we do in our clinic and often is done in the public health sector, in terms of social determinants of health, and that we know that access to safe housing is a social determinant of health. We know that access to a safe working conditions, a predictable schedule, the ability to care for your child, access to sufficient food in the house, all of those things that are very much tied to what kind of a job people have really determines quite often, you know, what kind of health folks have. Not to mention, do they have access to health care itself? Can they afford their medicines? Can they see the doctor when they need to?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a question from Chris on Twitter who asks, I wonder how precarious employment affects different communities differently. Do you have an answer for that?
Yes. In terms of communities, I guess it depends a little bit of how you define it. But if we look in terms of race and ethnicity, that folks, we have a significant race breakdown in terms of who has low wage employment, and persons of color, particularly our Black neighbors, our Black residents of Indiana and our Latino residents of Indiana are very much more likely to be in these low wage jobs. And beyond, as Professor Honan said, it's beyond just not having good wages. It's not having control over your environment, not having control over your schedule, which can be really difficult, in particular for parents who have to arrange childcare, not knowing whether you're going to have the job next week. And for us in the legal world, it's a really important question as to whether folks are considered to be, quote, independent contractors, or whether they're employees. We start off right away when we talk about employment law. Is this worker going to be protected as an employee? Because that, and Professor Ihonen mentioned, that means you get access to unemployment insurance. That means you get access to Medicare and Social Security contributions by your employer. That means anti-discrimination laws apply to you. Workers' compensation laws apply to you. But folks who are, quote unquote, gig workers or independent contractors, they have none of those protections.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know Emily mentioned that precarious employment disproportionately affects women and people of color. She just sent us a little chat, so I just want to bring that into the conversation as well. It just seems like, is there any solution for this? It just seems like this is a continual problem.
Well, I think that you and Professor Honan actually started to talk about that, and I would echo what she said in terms of all of the above. We can and should in the state of Indiana and nationally do much, much more to protect these workers in these workplaces, and also unionizing and folks coming together and using their power together as workers has historically proven to be enormously effective in terms of making these jobs better jobs. We talk about sometimes, oh, fast food jobs are bad jobs, or home care jobs are bad jobs because they don't pay well and they're pretty tenuous right now. But in the early 20th century, manufacturing jobs were bad, dangerous, and tenuous, and people got laid off randomly all the time. The union movement changed that. They turned those jobs into good jobs. And folks who were trying to unionize, folks who were trying to increase the minimum wage, trying to increase access to health care for all, they're trying to do what we saw happen in the early 20th century, is take work that has been deemed as precarious, as low wage, as something not deserving of great reward and respect, and turn that into a job that folks can raise a family on.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to Indiana, are there any sort of labor laws that are out there to support workers in precarious employment situations?
Indiana doesn't do very well in this category, to be honest. We do have a situation where the Indiana General Assembly a few years ago passed a law to actually increase the likelihood that workers are going to be considered as independent contractors if they are in the quote-unquote gig economy, if they're food service drivers or Uber drivers or something that's app-based. We also have our governor just recently turned down, or is in the process of trying to turn down, extra federal dollars for unemployment compensation, much of which would go to folks who are independent contractors who before the pandemic weren't eligible for unemployment compensation. We don't have terrific workers' compensation protection in terms of when folks do get hurt on the job. Other states do, frankly, quite a lot better than we do. And when you get down to the bottom line of what the paycheck looks like, Indiana has not raised the minimum wage above the federal minimum. Most states have, the majority of states have, including the states around us. Our minimum wage is stuck at $7.25 an hour. And the General Assembly has also preempted local governments from raising their minimum wage. So if the city of Indianapolis or the city of Evansville or South Bend wanted to raise their minimum wage, like has been done in places like Chicago and Los Angeles and New York and dozens of other cities, cities in Indiana are not allowed to do that because of the affirmative action by our General Assembly and our governors.
I'm curious, like who benefits from something like that? I mean, aside from maybe an employer who doesn't want to have to pay more money, but for the lawmakers, why would they be against it?
I think you've already answered the question. Is that, for instance, as an example, the recent decision by our governor to decline the extra unemployment compensation that all comes with federal money, no state money at all, an extra $300 a week for some workers, and for some workers, the only $300 a week that they would be getting. And the total is estimated to be about $1.5 billion into the Indiana economy. And a couple of economists have been quoted recently. Indiana economists are saying that the only winners of this decision are low-wage employers. The economy is hurt because that money isn't circulating in the economy. And, of course, these workers and their families are being hurt by the federal dollars being turned down. That's something that actually is being challenged in court literally right now. And so we'll see what happens. But the governor has said he is turning down that federal money and doesn't want that to be available for Indiana workers who are unemployed.
Right. And I did want to talk a little bit about that. There's a hearing today, I believe, on this.
There was a hearing this morning in Marion County Superior Court where plaintiffs have, including folks who are on these unemployment benefits right now, who have been deemed to be eligible for unemployment, losing jobs through no fault of their own, have challenged Governor Holcomb's decision. So we'll see what happens in the courts. But right now, the governor has said to the federal government, essentially, keep your money. We don't want it. And we're going to have, the estimate is 286,000 people across Indiana are going to have their benefits either reduced or completely eliminated by this decision. And what that does, Miriam, to your point, is I assume that the governor's intent is to force these folks back into the low wage workforce, into taking the third shift job or the fast food job that doesn't add up to 35 hours a week, that type of thing. And to essentially make Indiana folks desperate enough to take those low wage jobs. And that's something I personally think is not good for Indiana. And again, the plaintiffs and the folks bringing this lawsuit think the same.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around all this information here. So we're saying no to federal dollars just because there are a lot of places probably that are looking for employees to come back now that things are getting better. And that's a way to force them back to work.
Correct. Yes. That's my idea. Again, I don't speak for the governor, obviously. I'm not being hired as his spokesperson anytime soon. But yes, I think that's the fair way to put it. And again, the response that I would say, and a lot of other folks would say, is that if the jobs were good jobs, if the jobs were not precarious employment, as Professor Ahonen has so aptly described them, those people would be lining up to take those jobs. It would be enough for them to afford childcare. It would be enough for them to afford some assistance for them taking care of their elderly relative who's ill, that kind of thing that keeps people out of the workforce or limited in the workforce. Mm-hmm. And that... So if we had good paying, if the jobs available were good paying jobs that were stable, that would allow folks to raise their family with them, folks would be lining up for those jobs.
Yeah, I guess I'm just not understanding why you wouldn't just take the federal dollars for now and until they dry up.
Well, I would agree with you, and I hope a judge agrees with you as well. And again, that the legal argument is that that's what the Indiana General Assembly has said. When this dollar, the federal dollars are available for unemployment compensation, that it's the governor's obligation to pursue and accept those. So again, we'll see what the trial court decides and whether the case gets appealed. We'll find out soon whether the governor's decision will stand.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Do you know how Indiana compares to other states when it comes to precarious employment? Are we better or worse?
So I think it's yes and no. I think for the most part, we're not in the top half in terms of having the lower minimum wage and not having any particular state protections for family or maternal leave or sick leave or things like that. But I will say that one thing we do, we should be proud of and grateful for, is that we did expand Medicaid in Indiana, and an awful lot of folks who are working part-time, working at a low-wage job, et cetera, are relying on our Healthy Indiana plan, which is the Obamacare, essentially, expansion of Medicaid in Indiana. That's been a little bit in jeopardy a few times, but the last number I saw was that it's over 600,000 people across the state are receiving their health care through the Healthy Indiana plan, which means that's how they're getting their insulin, their asthma medicines, that's how they're going to the doctor. And we do that, and some states don't. Some very big southern states, Florida, Texas, for example, Missouri does not. And low-wage workers, what we call low-wage workers, but as Professor Ahonen said, precarious workers, in those states, they have no health care. Many of them have no health care at all. So we do, full credit to Indiana advocates and lawmakers, we do have at least access to health care for those folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another question from Chris on Twitter, who asks, what can a person formerly of precarious employment do to not bring the baggage of those working conditions to quality employment, i.e. worrying about getting fired out of the blue? I don't know if that's something you can answer or not.
Yeah, well, in terms of not getting fired out of the blue, Indiana, like most states, to be fair, is an employment at will state. So unless we have a contract from our employer, and most of us do not, or we are a member of a union and has a contract, and that's usually the path for someone to have an employment contract. For most of us, we can be fired at will, even folks with fairly higher paying positions. So that's a difficult challenge, but I do, I think it circles back to folks with union representation have the right to have just cause for their firing, have the right to a grievance procedure and even a hearing, some protections against being fired at will. And of course, anti-discrimination laws, Title VII at the federal level, should protect us from being terminated or somehow have a negative experience at the workplace due to race, ethnicity, age, and some other factors like that, gender and some other factors like that. But that, again, doesn't apply to independent contractors. So independent contractors, folks who aren't employees, have a lot less protections. They have some anti-discrimination protections, but not as much. So folks who are concerned about the precariousness of their employment, unfortunately, under the law, that's usually a pretty valid concern. Mm-hmm. But union representation changes that.
Well, if you can't get a union started, is there another way to change this at-will employment, or is that something that you have to do on a government level?
It's definitely at a government level. Well, you could try to persuade your employer to give you a contract and some kind of a guarantee of security. But since that's not the norm, very few employers will do that. And again, to be fair, Indiana is an employment at will state, but almost every state in the union is. That's an American approach right now. So there is some proposed legislation at the federal level that would try to start changing the idea of at-will employment, but we're pretty far away from that. It's been the norm here for quite some time. So in the employment law sector, you know, the response, the kind of boilerplate response that you get when somebody says, oh, I just lost my job, is to try to figure out if they're in a protected category for anti-discrimination laws. And if they're not, and if you just lost your job because your boss was in a bad mood that day, there's not a lot that the law does to protect folks in the U.S. It's different in other nations, but in the U.S. and in Indiana, definitely were employment at will, which is all the more reason for folks to have access to good wages and health care and benefits so that they have a cushion if something does happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, I know we asked Aaron earlier about some solutions to this. Are there any solutions on the horizon for precarious employment to sort of change that category?
I think so. I think that in terms of what happens when folks are precariously employed is that they struggle to put enough income in the household to pay the rent, to keep the lights on, to put food on the table. So whenever there are broader subsidies like access to subsidized housing, whenever there is living wage legislation, higher minimum wage, whenever there's access to health care broadly, all of those impact in a very positive way the folks in these precarious employment. So even if you can't fix the situation right at the workplace, you can and should, and we sometimes do, build up a safety net around folks so that the families aren't horribly impacted by the fact that the job isn't a great one.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Fran Quigley is a clinical professor at the IU Robert H. McKinney School of Law at IUPUI. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate your insight. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yase, and Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Chris Flood engineered the show today. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow as we revisit our conversation about social media. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.